The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to gamban.com to find out more.
Hello and welcome to the Problem Gambling Podcast. I'm Barry Grant, an addiction counsellor with Extern Problem Gambling, and my co-host is Tony O'Reilly, also an addiction counsellor with the project and the co-author of the book Tony 10. And today, for the last episode in this season of the podcast, we're delighted to have with us as our guests Charles and Liz Ritchie, founding members of the UK charity Gambling with Lives, to talk about their work and their great campaigning and their advocacy and all the wonderful things that they're doing all across the UK, including in Northern Ireland, where they have some projects rolling out there. So thanks so much for joining us today, folks. For the listener out there who may not know about Gambling with Lives, could you give us a kind of a brief idea of why you founded the charity in the first place?
Sure.
Yes, of course. And thanks for having us. Charles and I set up Gambling with Lives after our son Jack took his life because of gambling in November 2017. And what happened was we met up with other families, particularly another family in Sheffield, which is where we live, whose son, Chris, had died only 6 months before Jack and was the same age as Chris. So they were the same school cohort, just on opposite sides of Sheffield. And we met up with another family in the West Country, whose son Daniel had died only a month before Jack. And we all got together and we thought, this isn't just us. So we set off trying to find other families and did that through looking at local papers, making contact through funeral directors and through other charities, through suicide bereavement charities. And then in the August of 2018, a group of about 20 families met in Birmingham. And we all put pictures of the people that we'd lost on the board with sort of messages. And we went around the room and talked about the people that we'd lost. And honestly, it was like hearing the same story over and over again. So we thought, this is bigger than we ever thought. How many people are dying? And what happened parallel to this time, during the first half of 2018, Charles and I were going up and down to London, having sort of hundreds of meetings with politicians and the industry partner charities and different people. And we were met with this kind of incredulity, really, incomprehension. And to be honest, some real rudeness. But also at the same time, Charles was hitting the research. So I think you should talk about the research.
Yeah, well, as Liz says, I think when Jack died, we met the two families very, very soon after. So we went very quickly from thinking, yeah, because at that stage, you read very little, if anything, about gambling and suicide. You know, gambling was all about the amounts of money lost, and that was the story. So it was actually quite difficult contacting other families because the stories weren't there. But when we'd met those families, we kind of thought, well, okay. If there's another family in Sheffield this year and another family just a month ago, you know, how many people are dying every year? My background is in research. I was head of higher education research in Department for Education. So I set about really just reading to find out, well, you know, what is known about gambling and suicide. And I think shockingly, you know, I came really across in literature going back decades, linking gambling and suicide. And these were international studies. And there were a small number of studies which were actually about completed suicides. And from all of the, that, you know, I won't go through that whole process, but all of the putting together of that research, we came up with an estimate. There were between 250 and 650 gambling-related suicides every year in the UK. Now, I know that's That's a large number, and it's quite a wide range. But what all the studies were showing was that hundreds of people are dying every year through gambling-related suicides. And so that I think was the core message that we were taking out when we were having all this range of meetings. And as Liz says, it was staggering, really, the incomprehension or disbelief that we were met with. You know, we would talk about gambling suicides, and you'd be met with a blank expression of kind of almost, what are you talking about? So I think that was the start of our work, and I think that, you know, I think probably still that's one of the greatest things that Gambling with Lies has achieved has been to raise this profile that gambling does kill. Now, I know that anybody who is a recovering gambler would not be surprised at those sorts of numbers, because as you will both know, I'm sure, it's very rare to meet somebody who is a gambler in recovery who hasn't had serious thoughts about suicide, and many, many have made attempts on their own life. So, you know, the world out there, apparently, the regulators, the legislators, the treatment specialists, if I'm honest, were kind of in denial, whereas actually I think the gambling community knew that this was the case.
And to give you a kind of idea of the kind of rudeness that we had was people saying to us, well, it's only a tiny number, so, you know, it doesn't matter. In other words, your son's death doesn't matter. That was actually said to us on live television. And that's still said a lot, particularly by industry commentators. Well, we have to balance everybody's enjoyment with the tiny number of deaths. It's not a tiny number of deaths, but, you know, anyway, doesn't it matter that people are dying?
Absolutely. And of course, one death is one death too many. And I suppose what you're doing is so important, because one of the things that I suppose we come across in our work, and I'm sure you come across yourselves, is first, people don't understand that gambling can be addictive. Your average person in the street, so you're talking to politicians and other people, and they're looking at you like you've got two heads going, yes, hang on. how could this cause a death? Yeah. It's not even addictive. It's not like heroin. Yeah. It's not like cocaine or alcohol or other addictive substances. That's the first hurdle you have to get over. Then you have to get over the hurdle of, well, hang on, this stuff is harmful, right, at a very deep and meaningful level, apart from just the financial bit. Obviously, that can be devastating, but there's all these other harms attached to it. And then once you've gotten over that hurdle, you have to be able to convince people that not only is it can it be very harmful, it can be harmful to the level of death. So you're really up against it there. And I think that's why it's so important what you're doing. Sorry, Charles.
No. I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, we're not a gambling family, you know, like probably so many families. You know, I, as a child, you know, did put a bet on the Grand National through my dad and stuff like that. But gambling has never been kind of a part of our lives. So actually, genuinely, we didn't understand. And the information is not out there. Exactly what you're saying, just what a dangerous activity this is. And I think that the other thing, as Liz was saying, that the meeting that we had in Birmingham and hearing all these stories, which were so similar, bright young people from happy families who had effectively had a random encounter with gambling. Lots of stories of the early big wins and things like that. You know, there was just such commonality. And what it really brought home was that gambling disorder can happen to anyone. You know, there's again kind of a traditional idea that, you know, that gambling disorder happens to old men, they're in their 50s, it's after years and years of gambling and losing lots of money, etc. And there's that image of what a gambling addict is. And it just, you know, just didn't didn't match any of the people in the room. What was clear was you can take bright, happy, young people with no other problems in life, and they can fall victim to this. They can be pulled into gambling disorder. They can die from gambling disorder. And I think that, again, I think another thing that Gambling with Lives has been able to do has been able to call that out, because I think people who are in recovery, you know, they have lived with that model of it's your fault, you're to blame, you're weak, you're, you know, all the things, all of the responsible gambling model that the industry puts forward, not our products, it's you as individuals. And I think it's quite difficult, therefore, for somebody in recovery to say, well, hang on, yes, it's not all my fault. This was done to me. Now, we as parents, bereaved parents, looking at our children, knowing who our children were, knowing what our children were, we could actually call that out and say, you know, this model is wrong. It is because you have got highly dangerous products which are peddled relentlessly, and that is the cause of addiction, not weak people, not flawed individuals. And I think that that again has been really positive, a really positive move in terms of allowing then gamblers who are in recovery, all of whom take responsibility, crikey, they all take responsibility for their own recovery, etc., but for them to be able to say, okay, actually maybe it wasn't just me, you know, maybe actually the truth is that the industry is killing people. It is addicting people and killing people. And I think that's again, is a really important thing that Gambling's Lives has done.
And as families, we all feel that our children were abused.
Totally.
And the reality is that abusers always blame the victim the world over. And that's a way of abusers trying to avoid responsibility internally, really, for themselves. As to what they're doing. So what we've got here is abuse hidden in plain sight. And as well as the abusers, we have a whole set of people around them who don't want to see it. It's too big to see.
The point you're making. Sorry, I thought you were finished. Just slight delay. Apologies. Just a point to make. When I had my first bet in 98, it was the older cohort of people in the bookie office, in physical bookie offices. And that's when I got drawn in. But nowadays in our own service, we're seeing the cohort of people looking for help is extremely lower. It's kind of 23, 24, 25 year old men looking, yes, for, mainly men and some women as well, but looking for help and support, because my addiction has kind of was a slow burner over 10 years. Mm. People see now they're developing the problem over 6 months. Mm. And that's a huge difference. And that is down to, I believe, game design. It's down to how it's marketed. It's down to how it's been normalized, how it's been put in our pockets and our smart devices. So the landscape has definitely changed from when I had my first bet at 98, which was when I was 24, which is relatively late. Mm. Nowadays, it's 15, 16, 17 year olds. Like, I was, yes, doing a school talk last week.
Or younger even.
I was doing a school talk last week, and, you know, I often ask the questions, has anyone ever placed a bet? And sometimes there's all this quietness. And this fella said, yeah, I lost €200 last week on a horse. And I was saying, you shouldn't even be able to place a bet at 16. He was very open and honest. And I kind of said that to him. At the same time, it was as normal as losing €2. And because it was a family, it was a horse in these area or whatever. And that's really, really worrying. And for me, it's definitely like, especially one client, and he said it's okay for me to share bits of the story. One client said that he went from sports betting, which he found was okay, but as soon as he went online and onto the slots, he had that big win that you described.
Yeah.
But lost within a couple of weeks. And then suddenly the mindset changes because of the psychology that's built into the games, built into the gambling. So definitely, I know Barry will back me up on this. Like, our service, people who look to avail of our services, the age is definitely after coming down, especially in the last couple of years. And in my own recovery, when I got into recovery in 2011, there was nothing about gambling. Like I was going around frantically trying to find a book written by Usha McConville, thinking that there might be answers in this. Mm-hmm. And it was absolutely not, because it only really got, in the DSM-5, it went from an impulse control disorder to an addiction that's akin to substance use disorder. And it's only, we're still in its infancy in regards to getting the research, as you were saying, Charles, and getting the information, but we're still so far behind the curve, aren't we?
I think as well, yeah, as you say, just how quickly addiction happens. You know, again, as you say, the idea is that it's over decades and it's an old men's addiction. By the time we discovered Jack was gambling, looking back now, we can see that he was already had a deep, complex addiction, and it's weeks and months, not years. And I think that's something that makes, for me, gambling different to, say, smoking. There's often that sort of say, any cigarette can do you or does you harm, etc., etc. I think that gambling, harms can happen so quickly and so catastrophically in such a short period of time. I mean, you can't smoke yourself to death in a single day. You can lose your house, you can lose your life in a day's of gambling. And I think that a very common story of the deaths of so many of the people lost to gambling to lives, families, has been people, maybe having gambled for a number of years, not decades, because they're young people by and large. But that a kind of a common thing is that they come out of an intense session of gambling, often after relapse or reoccurrence, and they come out, they crash out of a gambling session, and they take their lives very quickly after that. We know that Jack died an hour and a half at the most after crashing out of a gambling session. He hadn't lost tens of thousands of pounds, he'd lost 1,500 quid or whatever, but he'd been gambling for a solid day. That session ended, as I guess so many sessions of gambling do end, because you literally run out of money. You have got no more access to money. And for him, he crashed out into the world where the long-term damage of gambling had been done to him. He'd taken on all of the that it was his fault, that he was the worst person in the world, that it was up to him to solve it. And he still had his gambling brain. It's something I always say is that, that when you've drunk your two bottles of vodka and you move off, you're not sober. And it's similar, you crash out of a gambling and you've still got your gambling brain. You've still got, the wild thinking that gamblers have when they're kind of in the zone. And that when you crash out into that world where you think you're the worst person in the world, then and you're totally physically capable, then suicide is an incredibly high risk. And we know now that gambling has the highest suicide rates of any of the addictions. And it kind of feels, because it has that long-term impact, but it has that short-term impact as well, that immediate impact, and you're physically capable. So it's a lethal mixture.
Yeah, and I think it's important. Well, there's a couple of things there. I mean, first of all, you mentioned this trick that the gambling industry do. The problem is in the individuals, flawed individuals, and they're born a certain way and they're born with this flaw, and our product is perfectly safe and we do all these things to ensure that people don't get into trouble, but there's always going to be a few flawed individuals who go off the rails, right? That trick is as old as the hills. The alcohol industry have been doing that one for generations, saying that the problem is in the man, not the bottle, right? That's as old as the hills, that trick. And they all tend to work off the same playbook, right? So that's the first thing. The gambling industry know full well it's an addictive product, and they do everything in their power to make it as addictive as humanly possible, right? And they know that X percentage of their customers are going to become addicted to the product, right? That's the first thing. I mean, and the other thing is, okay, you're talking, obviously you started gambling with lives a number of years ago, and you were operating from a belief that gambling was the root cause of all these suicides. Now, I suppose it's important for the listeners to know that recently you had a coroner's report into your son Jack's case, where that opinion, that belief was vindicated by the coroner. Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. So the coroner found...
Jack died 4.5 years ago, but actually the final inquest only completed about a month ago. A whole variety of reasons why that was so long drawn out, partly COVID, obviously. But what we managed to get in Jack's inquest was what's called an Article 2 hearing. So Article 2 of the European Human Rights Act, which is basically that questioning whether the state had failed to protect Jack's right to life. And at one of the early hearings with the coroner, and he was a very senior guy, treated us brilliantly, actually. We can go into the reasons to that another time, but he was very senior, and he even at those early stages when we had told him the basics of Jack's story and what had happened, he saw, you know, he didn't know anything about gambling, of course, but he saw that there was something that needed to be investigated here. He saw there's a social implication in this death. So he effectively ruled that it should be heard under Article 2, which therefore meant that it was more, the investigation was more than when, where and how of the death. It was the circumstances surrounding. And in particular, the areas that he highlighted were the lack of treatment which was available, which we all know just how appallingly, well, we could talk about that another stage, but weeks in treatment. And then the other thing being complete lack of information. So this whole stuff about, you know, which you said at the start, is gambling even addictive? You know, anything about gambling, so that we as parents, Jack as an individual, Jack, when he started gambling in the local bookies, in his lunchtime with his school friends, was engaged, as far as the world was concerned, in a fun activity, another fun leisure activity. He wasn't stepping into something which was, you know, like taking some heroin or whatever. He was in a high street activity. So, you know, the coroner highlighted that lack of information. The other thing which actually the inquest investigated was also regulation. And one of the things that the coroner concluded was that despite there being a system of regulation in place, it failed to prevent Jack from gambling when he was plainly addicted. So in other words, you've got an inadequate system of regulation as well. So it was a very, very powerful, I mean, it was a long drawn out process, and we were opposed, you know, the other interested parties. So in other words, saying it wasn't about gambling, it wasn't about these failures. We had lined up, we had Department of DCMS, Culture, Media and Sport, the Gambling Commission, Gamble Aware, industry funded charity, and GamCare, the main provider of treatment outside the NHS. Industry funded again. Those people were effectively challenging the role of gambling in Jack's death. And, you know, again, as a citizen, you don't come across inquests. That's the first inquest I have ever attended. And it was quite shocking. It was quite shocking to see how they were trying to portray effectively that this was Jack. It was something about Jack. It was other things in his life. It was a weakness in him. It wasn't gambling.
Or us as a family. Yeah. So that they very much tried to take a position that suicide always has multiple causes was the position that gets said a lot. Whereas actually the evidence that was heard was that there were no other factors. Nobody could find any other factors. There was nothing else in Jack's life that would trigger a suicide, although there'd been extensive investigation, but they were still taking that position. So effectively what we had was the state and the charities that are supposed to provide information and treatment trying to offlay the blame from themselves for not providing enough information or treatment by blaming Jack or blaming us.
And so very, very powerfully, the coroner not only found that, that gambling led to Jack's death, he also issued what are called a prevention of future deaths notice, which were basically went to the Department of Health, Department of Education and DCMS, which were basically finding the range of failings around information and treatment, effectively demanding a response from those departments to the coroner to say, this is what we will do to make changes to prevent future deaths. Now, some of those I'm sure will end up being, well, we're reviewing the Gambling Act, et cetera, and there'll be a whole range of changes to that. So one of the things that we have done is we have written to those departments on the back of the prevention of future deaths, saying, being a bit more explicit, saying, you know, the particular things that we would like to see including that legislation, as well as treatment, which of course isn't included in the Gambling Act review. And so something like, for instance, you know, the statutory levy, which, you know, we regard as one of the absolutely essential elements of any changes for the future, to ensure that you have robust and adequate funding, which is independent from the industry. You know, we've got the ridiculous situation where the industry controls research or funds research. It funds the education messages that go out. It funds the treatment, you know, and that is just, you know, it's when you talk to people who again know nothing about this, and you sort of say, yeah, everything is dependent on industry funding, again they look at you and go, what, you know, is that cannot be the case. We don't have the tobacco industry funding awareness programs in school, etc. We obviously have had decades of the tobacco industry funding research around the harmfulness or not harmfulness of smoking, and we're kind of decades behind in gambling, and I know that that's an issue across the world, and I know that that's the case in Ireland, isn't it? And you I'm sure would be campaigning for the same thing of a statutory levy.
The coroner was quite shocked by the lack of messaging, and he made a big thing about the potential to have a message of gambling kills that is similar to smoking kills. He also was quite shocked by the lack of knowledge of GPs. So we were very clear that we didn't want clinicians to be blamed who failed to diagnose Jack, failed to provide treatment. It wasn't the clinician's fault, individual clinicians. They had no training, they had no knowledge. It was just so clear. And the coroner was clearly shocked by that. And the lack of it's the lack of awareness in the NHS. And that's what's really important. You know, it was really striking that the industry-funded charities who provide treatment were and information were opposed to us and were trying not to take any responsibility. If there's one thing the NHS does, it takes responsibility and for our help, for our health and for help to us all. And the coroner was really clear about that there needed to be in the NHS training for GPs, a proper NHS pathway into NHS treatment. And that's what we're campaigning for now.
Yeah, and I mean, you made so many great points there. I mean, we've been campaigning in the Republic of Ireland for, to have a regulator in the first place. We have zero regulation, none whatsoever. Yeah. And I suppose what was actually proposed by the government in their own legislation was a mandatory statutory levy. I think they proposed 1% of turnover, which would be substantial. Mm. Yeah. Mm. And it has to be that. And like I seem to recall a previous CEO of the Gambling Commission in the UK, or the GB Gambling Commission, talking about some of the gambling companies sending in checks for one penny as their voluntary contribution. And there was a large company that was sponsoring Everton's shirt, for spending millions on sponsoring Everton's shirt. They sent in a voluntary donation contribution of £50. Like, this is derisory. Now, there are other ones. It's just as bad if they make large donations, right? On the other end of the scale, because they control you, they own you, and you end up with a bizarre, thoroughly bizarre, absurd situation where the very organizations that should be standing up to the gambling industry and calling out the harms that are caused by the gambling industry are taking you guys on at an inquest for your son's gambling related suicide. Like, this is
absolutely crazy. Barry, I think that one of the shocking things that again on our discovery of how this whole system worked was exactly what you're saying, is that the organizations who must have known the scope and scale of harms, the treatment specialists, the industry funded treatment specialists, they were effectively silent about that. They are the ones who are responsible for messaging. They're also the ones who should have been there, you know, at the front of the queue, shouting as loud as possible, "We need more resources." But they weren't, you know, they maintained a neutral stance on FOBTs, as to whether FOBTs were dangerous. They are the people who must have been getting people in through the doors every day, seeing the harms and the level of harms that we're doing, and they remain silent. Now, maybe they didn't think they were dangerous activities. If they believe that, then they believe that. Or is it just that that's where their funding was coming from and they were not going to upset their paymasters? And I know where I sit on that.
Yeah, but the strongest fundamental drive of all living creatures, including humans, is self-preservation, right? That's number one primary focus. Yeah. Nobody bites the hand that feeds them.
Yeah.
I don't care how ethical you think you are, right?
Yeah.
You just don't, right? So the ethical thing to do is never to enter into that Faustian pact in the first place.
Totally.
That's the only starting point that any organization in the space can really take.
It kind of feels like, sorry to interrupt. I mean, it sort of kind of feels like cancer specialists, you know, just remaining silent about the role of cigarettes and just saying, you give us 5 million to treat that. Thank you very much. And we'll keep our heads down and see what we can do with that. Just wouldn't happen, would it? You know, you'd have those people, cancer specialists, leading the campaign, A, for public health messaging around smoking, but B, to secure the resources to treat it as well. So it's,
Folks, I know you're tight for time today and you've given so generously of your time today and you do such amazing work. And I know you're at it day in, day out, all of the time at the moment. Before we sign off today, I mean, you've touched on a couple of things there, but obviously there's the gambling review in the UK. We have a gambling regulation bill in the Republic of Ireland going through the various processes in our parliament at the moment in Northern Ireland, which has devolved rules around gambling. They're working on their land-based regulations currently, and then they're going to move on to online. So there's a lot of stuff in play at the moment. What would be your ideal scenario in terms of what you're looking for robust, meaningful gambling regulation that might prevent future suicides?
Wow, is that another full program?
Well, what are your top your headline asks?
I mean, obviously we've talked about the levy, and I do think that that is absolutely fundamental, because I think without that we won't get the public health messaging, we won't get the level of treatment, etc. So that's taken as given, I guess. I think around regulation, we do see affordability checks as being at the core, and so, you know, that's not preventing people from gambling whatever amounts of money if they've got that amount of money, but it's having an affordability check triggered at a low enough level to capture people before they have developed an addiction, and I think there seems to be a general acceptance that, you know, we do need something around affordability. There are just too many horror stories of people losing fantastical amounts of money in a very short period of time. But on a general affordability, people seem to be We would campaign for a trigger to start it when somebody's losing £100 a month, that sort of level.
But a soft cap.
A soft cap. So that, you know, that if you've got the, you know, if you've got the income resources, etc., you know, you're not prevented. And I think at the moment, realistically, that can only happen for online. And I think, you know, that we would say where that is probably where the most dangerous products are. You know, online casino slot games we think are the most dangerous. Now, I know that all gambling carries a risk, so, but, you know, in terms of online is where affordability really has to start. And it does need to be that sort of level of 100. People are talking, say, taking maybe 500. That's where the industry is. If £500 a month, you know, there are not many people who can really afford that. And, you know, Jack, and we didn't say this earlier, Jack did not lose fantastical amounts of money during his gambling. He wouldn't have been picked up with a £500 limit until actually probably about 2 years before he died, you know, by which time he had, you know, incredibly deep-seated. So you have to have, you know, affordability triggered at a low level, around about the 100. Now, actually, you know, the industry, you know, cries, you know, black market and people never do it, etc., etc. Yet the vast majority of people get nowhere near losing £100 per month. Yet again, it's this myth that we're, you know, we want to gamble on everything 24 hours a day, you know, we must gamble. Actually, I think it's sort of about 7% of people gamble more than once a week. You know, we're not talking about the you know, the very fabric of the nation being, you know, challenged by having affordability checks. It's just, again, it's this nonsense. So, and that also then, to be workable, does need to be done kind of across all operators. So you've got to have something like a single customer view. And I know that in the UK, you know, the Gambling Commission has at the moment handed the task of development of that sort of product, a single customer view, to the industry. Now, that's just not going to work. You know, that is what people object to, is actually giving their details, their financial details, to a bookie. You know, so it has to be taken out of the industry. That needs to be done by an independent body. I think the other thing as well would then be about making products safer as well. You know, that I think that you know, the FOBTs was the first admission by government that, hang on, we've got something on the market which in its current form is just too dangerous. I think, you know, we know there's the same products and worse online. So I do think that there needs to be kind of a pre-testing of products, we would say, in terms of safety testing. It's not just fairness testing. And that, I think, would therefore involve putting stake limits on. It would probably involve reducing the speed of some games. Yeah, so I think there's a variety of stuff that needs to happen around individual product regulation as well.
And the other major thing is advertising, of course.
Yeah, of course.
So this normalisation and predatory marketing. So there's this kind of weak and feeble kind of suggestion, which at least is a step in the right direction by the Advertising Standards Agency that's just come out. But it's pretty low level, really. And the reality is that the industry are targeting people who are younger and younger, as you've rightly said, because they're generating their next generation of customers. Because the customers get used up. They either die or they go into treatment. And therefore you've got to generate more. So it's literally, I mean, I see it as parasitic, really, as sucking the life out of young people. Their work, their draining their money is draining their life force, really, to work. And therefore the advertising and the promotion, this predatory promotion of this as a normal leisure, essentially economic activity, as opposed to something that harms mental health, has to be challenged, has to be stopped. We have to stop it.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I suppose, yeah, definitely the advertising thing. I thought there was a lot of stuff online about the advertising standards rule coming in yesterday, but when you look at the devil in the detail, and those things, voluntary codes and slaps on wrists, and we have similar things here. Like, we would want to see gambling advertising coming under the remit of a regulator, and well, ideally there's a bill actually going through the Irish Parliament at the moment to ban it outright.
Yes.
So that'd be pretty good. Now
that would be amazing. Wow. That would be so helpful to us.
Yeah
Is that likely to succeed, Barry, do you think?
I think it's more likely, if it gets enacted at all, that it might be a watered down version where we get a pre-watershed ban. But pre-watershed ban, I think, would be certainly better than the current situation where it's just 24/7, 365 everywhere across all media platforms. And in the other kind of the main regulation bill, there are some quite progressive proposals, but in that for social media and platforms like YouTube, where you'd have to opt in to see gambling advertising. Now that, when you're dealing with global tech companies, could be tricky, but the ideas are sound. I suppose maybe there'd be one other thing I might throw in there with the kind of online casino type products like slots and other, the most addictive end of the sale will be built in time limits, built in breaks and
points. Yes.
So where you couldn't have somebody gambling, like I have seen data sets from inside some of these kind of online gambling companies where people are gambling unbroken spells of like 45, 48 hours.
Wow.
Which of course the gambling companies can see.
Yeah.
They can see that from the data. They can see it in real time, I imagine, as well. And nobody's gone, you need to take a break here, go for a walk, have sleep, eat some food, do something else, you know. I would throw that in the mix as well. Tony, any thoughts or questions before we finish up?
I probably have loads, but I know we're trying to finish up. I suppose I was at the launch in Belfast, and I got to meet the both of you. I know Liz less so. I know you were very busy that day. I only got to barely sit on. I had a really good chat with Charles, and I was very, very taken back by Sadie when she spoke at the launch, and it impacted me. And I knew today it was going to impact me as well. I was very emotive at the start. I probably am a bit now, because that could be my parents sitting there talking to Barry. And so I think the work you're doing is so, so important. I remember one thing that really hit me when Sadie was speaking, saying that, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I was in a bit of a mess listening to her, that, you know, with her son, it was that he said he just wanted peace in his, and a lot of times people look at the gambling as financial assistance, but it's that headspace that you get into. And it's so overwhelming. And it really is. I'm sitting here with a mix of emotions that I'll probably have to sit with for a while afterwards. And luckily, I don't have a client for a couple of hours, because I get very angry when I hear some of the things you're saying. And when I'm doing the school talks, I show a little bit of video from the documentary was done on my story. And at the end of it, to say, like, things, I just summarize the things that we've done since Tony's case, we have dramatically increased our safety and all that. And that's not what we're seeing on the cold face. That's not what we're seeing. And that bit really, really gets me, because I can accept that there was failings in my case. That was 11 years ago. Like, you know, it's a different landscape back then, but this shouldn't be happening today. And it's the same things. And I'm with myself and Barry get calls day in, day out, week in, week out. And it's the same failings where it is predatory. It's anyone in the street looking at the data that they have would see that someone has a problem, but yet they're not stopping it. And that's the bit that gets me, because it's all this, it's kind of put out there as when the fun stops, or take time to think, or, you know, and that, and even those messages, you'd have to nearly, you know, blink an eye and you'll miss them at the end of the ads or the end of the thing. And it's always packaged up as this fun thing and all this. And it's not, like, my reality of it is far from that. Your reality now of it's far from that. And that we need that balance of a public health awareness, independent, as you said, awareness program to show that this gambling can kill, this gambling does kill, or it has killed. And to have that messaging out there in the same way as we have it with road safety, with alcohol, with drugs. Because at the moment, it's still packaged up as this fun. Even the safer gambling ads are out there. It's people, you know, having fun, and it's these messages coming on top of it. It's not good enough, because people are, you know, losing their lives because of this. People are getting financial difficulties. And I've heard, my story is at the extreme end of money, the money side of it. That's the bit people focus on, but that's so far from my reality of it. It's my reality of being in that space where it's like someone trying to beat the way out of my head with a sledgehammer. And that I always, the message I always try to get across, because it's not just the financial, because people hear the story, Tony 10, the 1.75 million, all this stuff. That's a small bit of my story. The story is that I was in that position where, you know, suicidal ideation, it's a horrible place to be because you feel so alone in that moment. And we need to change people's opinions, perceptions about what gambling is and about how addictive it is. And the work that you're doing is absolutely amazing in bringing that to the fore. And people always say to me, you're so brave for sharing your story, blah, blah, blah. But what you're doing is putting yourselves out there. And I can see by talking to you today, it's still emotive now about it. And each time I tell a story at different times, it gets very emotive. But to be able to have the strength and courage to do that, and what has already saved lives and will continue to save lives, that is huge. And that's a great legacy to be able to carry on for the work that you're doing.
No, thank you for saying that.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. And I'm not surprised and pleased to hear that you still get angry because, you know, exactly what you say, this is happening today. We're contacted by families every week. And, you know, these aren't deaths that happened 5 years ago. These are deaths that are happening now, and they're happening with big companies. It's not some little fly-by-night sort of, you know, foreign black market overseas thing. These people are dying with well-known high street named companies, and it's just, you know, I'm furious about it. And when you hear people sort of saying, oh, we're, you know, the BGC used to say, we admit we weren't best in class 2 years ago, but we're so much better now.
It's actually not true.
It's just, you know, they need to open their eyes and see what is happening in their companies today.
Yeah, and just to remind people that Sky Betting and Gaming sent out thousands of free bets to self-excluded customers in November of last year during the gambling industry's Safer Gambling Week. Yeah. That's not 2 years ago. It's not 20 years ago. November of last year, and if that's what their idea of best in class is, I think we've got a serious problem on our hands. So, look, we know anybody working on the front line or talking to people on the front line knows what the real situation is. They can spin that story till the cows come home. You need a serious regulator with teeth and a big stick that's going to regulate this space. Folks, listen, thank you so much for giving of your time today, and thank you so much for the work that you're doing. And I think it's just briefly, I mean, Tony was talking about the amazing work that you're doing, the impact that it has. People tend to blame the gambler. So they stigmatize the gambler, they demonize the gambler. And for anybody like Tony or other people who are in recovery, they will get a certain bit of that. Most people are fairly kind of accepting and are grateful that Tony and others are sharing their stories. But some people will still kind of continue to blame the gambler. But for bereaved families, you know, it just takes the whole conversation into another place where that blame and that stigmatization and demonization of the individual for gambling can't be directed, I think, at an organization like yours, which I think that it's tragic.
Don't you believe it? We're getting trolled.
Really? That's amazing.
Yesterday we had one that's blaming us for somebody having their account shut down.
Wow. It is extraordinary.
I've just lost all faith in humanity. That is absolutely tragic. Okay. But look, I think what you're doing for the vast majority of people is so meaningful and so impactful and connects with people in a totally different way where they can get a better understanding of the severe impact of gambling addiction on a person's life and the lives of their loved ones who get left out of the conversation so much. And of course, for every person with a gambling problem, there are multiple family members usually whose lives are negatively impacted. So listen, Charles and Liz, thank you so much for doing what you're doing and for taking the time to talk to us on the podcast today. Take care and thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Barry. And thanks, Tony.
Thank you.
The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to gamban.com to find out more.
Thank you.